EWA-517, do you want to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's Merge 1095. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Do we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
And a dispatch. Bob, I swear to God, 4 calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
4 calls.
4 calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. Hello and welcome to the show, everyone, wherever in the world you are joining us from tonight. Tonight's guest is Mike Heston Rogers, host of The Realist on KGRA and witness to the Travis Walton incident of 1975 and the Phoenix Lights of 1997. And he'll be talking about what he saw and experienced with both events and his interest in natural illusions. And if you've had an experience you would like to share on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. or via the contact page on my website, ufochroniclespodcast.com. And while you're there, you can listen to past shows, grab yourself a podcast t-shirt, or even enter this month's competition. If you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to www.patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode below. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show. To welcome Mike Heston Rogers to the show.
How you doing?
I really appreciate you taking the time and coming on today, Mike.
You bet.
Mike is the host of The Realist on KGRA, and Mike is also a witness to two of the most famous UFO incidents there are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mike, you had a front row seat to the Travis Walton incident of 1975 and also the Phoenix Lights of 1997, both with multiple eyewitnesses and both in Arizona.
Yes. Well, that's why that happened to me. I have never had an experience outside of Arizona. In fact, even the Phoenix Lights started in northern Arizona, pretty close to where I live. So it's not like a big coincidence. I mean, it is a coincidence, but it's not like outlandish, okay? And the thing is that Travis Walton's abduction, which, of course, we didn't actually witness. We just witnessed the vehicle, which was spectacular and awe-inspiring and then very, very frightening later. But the Phoenix Lights is something which a lot of people, if they weren't unbiased, if they were just believers, and which I really haven't found anybody yet who isn't a believer of the Phoenix Lights. And that's created a big problem for me, because when I saw that thing, I was in Prescott or near Prescott. I was on a hill. I was taking video, trying to get video of the Hale-Bopp Comet. But it was too dark. And, of course, this was back in analog time. It was a very good camera, a very good video camera, professional, but the Hale-Bopp Comet just wasn't showing up. even though no matter how I adjusted the shutter or anything. So wasn't happening. I put it away. And while I was getting ready to leave, I looked and saw these lights coming up. To make a long story short, I mean, without going into too much detail anyway, I took the advantage of the situation. I stayed there because, you know, in 1975, when that happened to us and Travis, you know, I told myself, if anything like this ever happens again, I won't just walk away or act afraid or anything. I'll get right on it. And that's was my frame of mind. So when I saw those lights coming up, at first I thought it was a bunch of helicopters actually flying in some sort of a formation. But it was kind of weird because they were like Blue Angels, you know, perfect alignment and all this, you know. But they were also brighter than you'd expect a helicopter. Or in fact, helicopters don't usually have straightforward like airplanes, you know, with landing lights. You know, I've flown helicopter and stuff, but that's what I thought it was. And they just came up slowly and slowly. They looked slow. They actually weren't slow. But by the time they got kind of over me, they were off to my right a ways. And I didn't know that anybody else was seeing this, you know. I just thought, well, this is really strange, you know. It was very interesting, you know. And then it turned out into spectacular. And they went over me almost, and I noticed as it went past and was headed pretty much south, I noticed that there was a cold breeze on the back of my neck. You see, this was was still winter, you know. In fact, it wasn't a real cold night or anything, but it was a chilly night, and the wind on the back of my neck was kind of cold, but it was a wind, and that was unusual. Because the wind doesn't come out of the north in Arizona. Sometimes a light breeze, you know, if it's, you know, nearly almost no wind, you know, I mean, when wind happens in Arizona, it's coming out of the southwest. And that's the first thing I noticed. I thought, what in the world? And I could see that this object was, which, by the way, I could see an actual outline of an object, not... Because I was up on a hill that was a little over 7,000 feet in elevation, which is pretty close. I don't know of anybody else around there that was actually on a hill like that. So when you say ringside seat, it's, yeah, it was ringside. And I saw a definite shape, and there was no helicopter or airplanes with it. There was no sound, but it was carried on the wind. I could see that. And it was headed the same direction of the wind, like it would have been, you know, if it was a balloon and like that, which I later realized it was carried on lighter than air substance of some kind, because it looked that way from where I was. And then after it went past, I chased it. But one thing I'd say about it is that because of my working in the woods, which I was at the time, well, I have all my life, one with capacity or another. But on that particular night, I used something that I've always been able to do in my profession, and that's something I call snap triangulation. And you have to be almost an artist at it to make it work. But I've been an artist. I'm very good at things like that. I create photorealistic paintings, but. Snap triangulation, I want, without going through the details, you create a triangle with a small bottom, like they 10 feet to your right, 10 feet to your left, and then you triangulate. You have to use a planimeter, a device that finds an angle on the basis of gravity, and you find one particular spot on it, like say you go left, and then real quickly you get over to the right. And then you find the same spot on the object, and you can determine how far away it is that way. And you can determine overall size, and you can determine speed, elevation, size, and speed. And I did all those, and that's why I call it snap triangulation. I mean, it's, you know, always had that term, but that told me those things. And it was around 11,000 or so feet high when it came over me. And from that position, which was over 7,000 feet, I could see it very, very well. Then it went on past and just disappeared really towards the south, because this was in the forest. There were a lot of trees. And I got in my pickup truck, and chased it. And I don't know if anybody else has done that. I never heard of anybody. But I chased the thing. And I went down that freeway. It's just a regular highway going from Prescott over to the freeway. And I took that way too fast. And I got on the freeway, and I was doing like 110. And I was afraid I was going to get caught, but I didn't. However, once I got down to the valley, which it didn't take that long, I was afraid, because when the traffic started picking up and everything, I realized that there had to be a patrolman around there somewhere. And certain, I pulled off, and it was at a place called Anthem. I pulled off the road onto a little hill there, and I watched it. I didn't quite catch up to it, okay? But it was still up there where I could see it well, and it went down. And I knew by this time that it was moving at between 70 and 80 miles an hour. And most of the people in the Phoenix Valley said, oh, no, it was hovered a lot of the time, doing 15 miles an hour, maybe 30. Well, that's an illusion. Yeah, one of the illusions that I've gotten into, because I've studied illusions concerning the Phoenix Lights as well as Travis Walton's thing and another incident that happened to us 5 years before that, and other things, you know, lights in the sky, things that turned out not to be UFOs, ETVs. But anyway, watch that thing go down over the South Mountain. And since being in Prescott was just something where I went to go see a friend who happened to, his name was Alan Dallas. He's deceased now, but he lived there in Chino Valley, which is just north of Prescott. And he wasn't home. I was on my way to the valley. I just decided to stop by and see him. And he wasn't home. His parents weren't home. He lived in like a trailer behind his parents. And so since I was heading the valley anyway, it kind of prompted me to follow the thing as well when I did take off after it. But when I got down to the valley, of course, I got a hotel room just like I was. In fact, I already had one reserved. And the next day, I went over to Channel 12. I believe it was Channel 12. Could have been 10. I think it was 12. I wanted to find out about the weather, you know, and they couldn't tell me anything, but they gave me a number of the National Weather Service. And then that afternoon, I got hold of them, and they had this thing called the Daily Weather Charts, and I ordered some. And within less than a week, I got them. Of course, it was back up on the mountain that I got them. And that's when I knew that what I had seen was carried on the wind for certain, because it was the exact same path. And it was a slightly curving path. In fact, it created like a reverse S shape down across Arizona. When it was coming over Prescott, it was coming out of the northwest. Then from there on down, the wind turned, and so did the object, and went not quite due south, but almost. And then down past Phoenix, not quite to Tucson, it started curving to the right, to the left, I mean, like as if you're going its direction. And it started making that curve towards the southeast, and it was a swooping thing, which actually went more and more east. In fact, by the time the wind, at least, got down past the corner of Arizona there, it was going almost east. But from those charts, I could determine a number of things. And since I already knew the elevation, later on, I got information from Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting and Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington. He had put this map out, but he also told me about pilots who had called in, who had actually gone out to investigate that object. And the report is that one of them made it back to the Air Force base, and he was so shaken, he could hardly get out of his jet. All the guys that saw it, there was more than one plane, and they were shaken. So whatever it was, even though it wasn't what people thought it was, it scared people anyway because it very much looked like that. Later on, I put it all together and found that just deductive reasoning, pretty much, because the weather documentation was definite. The elevation of the thing was definite. The size of the thing was definite. Everything about it was a fact. It was carried on the wind, both the S, slightly reverse S-shaped curving path down across Arizona, the elevation, which went from at its highest about 14,000 feet down to 9,000 feet over Phoenix, and all that's documented. And then it went a little lower than that, and then it picked up and got a little higher again after it, because the terrain, you know, over Phoenix is low. And then when you go south of there, it gains a few hundred feet. And the object was following the wind, and the speed of it was, I don't know what the speed of it was before I took measurements, and I don't know exactly what the speed it was after, at least not personally, but I determined that from the wind. And a lot of these gurus, you know, UFO gurus, I call them, you know, like, well, Peter Davenport's definitely one. But Lynn Cate, Dr. Lynn Cate, supposedly doctor, she wrote this book called The Phoenix Lights, and it was a bestseller. But they all said the object was moving way too fast, even though they were talking about how slow it moved. They gave all these reports of how slow it moved over Phoenix, and they never mentioned that was an illusion. I determined that later because I've studied illusions. They don't like me. Frank Cate, Peter Davenport, and most of the people who believe in the Phoenix Lights think I'm an idiot. And yet, I have the only actual documentation to prove anything. And the skeptics won't say anything. I had Michael Shermer on my show. Oh, gosh, it was like 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, maybe. And he's number one skeptic. You know, he's pretty much the most outspoken skeptic of today. He promised me that he would take my scientific abstract that I wrote about. You know, actually, the MUFON Journal published my scientific abstract. And it's very scientific, no nonsense, just straightforward. And that's in the May issue, 2019, under the heading Letters to the Columnist. That didn't get a whole lot of, well, it didn't get any negative response. I got a lot of positive response from my friends who are also realists and ufologists and whatnot, but very little comment otherwise. Nobody would refute it, but they just didn't believe in it. And I found that to be true about basically, in fact, I call the people who believe too much in the paranormal or UFOs, I call them eager believers. It's a term I came up with to describe people who just insist on believing. They will ignore even the vital facts of something. It's amazing. It's called bias. It's called preconception. And that's why I say I'm unbiased. That's why I call myself a realist, is because you have to be unbiased with things. And I was very unbiased both about Travis Walton's incident and about the Phoenix Lights. One was positive and the other was negative, which in a way proves my unbiasedness. That's not a word, by the way. But anyway.
It is now, Mike.
Okay. Unbiasedness. Yeah.
I like the fact you're a realist, and I think it is very, very important in this field. And before we get to Travis, now, when it comes to natural illusions, for those out there who don't quite understand, could you go into a little bit of detail about what a natural illusion is, please, Mike?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, I coined the term natural illusion. I couldn't find that anywhere either. What that is, it's like there's three categories, okay? You know, there's man-made illusions, okay? And everybody knows about those. And those can be good, they can be deceitful, or they can be very good. You know, advertisements, which might annoy a lot of people, do me, even though I use them on KGRA, whole reason basically is to sell advertising, but not me particularly, but you know, KGRA themselves, that's their business. But man-made delusions also include things like movies. And digital technology has made movies today, you know, the good ones, the high-budget ones, so believable you, in lots of ways, you can't tell the difference. The only way you can tell what's going on there, because pictorially, you know, they are very real. You can't tell. And they're moving, you know. And they're sometimes they'll even be in three-dimension. You know, you can watch them with the 3D glasses. And they're very, very desirable, you know. So I call that particular illusion effect, and it's a natural illusion to start with, because that's what the man-made illusions, in other words, the movie makers, that's what they use. They use natural illusion to create man-made illusions, you know, called movies. So they combine them. And of course, people experience them as a natural illusion, and they also experience them as a matter of their mind, because all of these things are of the mind. You can't get away from that. It's a matter of perception wherever you go. And but you know, the basic categories are man-made illusions, illusion of the mind, and natural illusion. And the difference is man-made illusions, you already know what those are. Illusions of the mind, those are things that you should ignore, but most people don't. Natural illusions are things that you cannot ignore. They are going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. I mean, nothing. And that's especially like the big ones. And I'm an astronomer, so I've gone way into stars and all that stuff. And you can actually find pretty much most of this stuff anyway, the big stuff, the stuff that I, you know, might say illustrate or present as a main illusion. Most of them are natural illusions. Some of them are other things, but effect is a big one. And that's what happens with the movies. And of course they call them special effects, but they're talking about the things that they do manually when they say that, but they're using the effects, for instance, 3D. And there's one of my illustrations of four effects on my Mike Heston Rogers Facebook page, which says effect. It's four effects. And you, if you look at it, and you have to kind of cross your eyes a little, and you will see the effect. It becomes 3D. And there are three effects there. One is that there's like five lines of print. And when you look at it, you'll know, of course, you center on a star. There's a star there that I created for the purpose. And it's not a star that has, it's actually not photorealistic. It's deliberately done with like large pixels so that you see these large squares that create the star. I mean, they're small, but you can still see them. And that's for the purpose of being able to focus clearly on this. Because this you do without glasses or anything, you just do it right there on my page. And those five lines are three things. Number one, they are at variable distances closer than the star. They're all lopsided, all the lines, but when you look at them that way, they become centered over the star. And the third thing is, this is another thing which is partly based on effect and everything. The first line, which looks dim, all the way down to the last line, which looks rather bright, are actually not in that configuration at all. In actuality, the brightest line is the dimmest, and the dimmest line is the brightest. Photo expert or anybody, actually anybody, could, if they've got like paint or whatever on their computer, they can put that in there, and then they can check out the actual colors for brightness and whatnot, and you'll find out that's true. So there's three of those illusions. But that's just that one. Now, the other stuff, that's the only one that's three-dimensional. But that shows you. And the thing about effect, all the human senses, every single one of them, which are 3D, except for taste and smell, and there's more of them, by the way, than the five that they say there are, five senses. And then they say there's the sixth sense. No, if you include the actual senses, they bump the sixth sense up to seventh, you know? So I didn't know what else to do with that, because I couldn't call any of those a seventh sense. But, you know, the one they leave out is balance. They always leave it out. And I asked one of my professors one time, what in the world, why is balance not with the rest of them? He said, well, balance happens in the same place as your hearing. So it's lumped in with hearing. I says, well, heaven's sakes, they have included taste and smell. Those are pretty much the same thing. And they are not three-dimensional. They are two-dimensional. There are some lizards in Australia which can sense the direction of a smell with their tongue because they have a forked tongue, and they actually sense the stronger thing on the side of the tongue that is the closest to the smell. And they have three-dimensional smell or taste, whichever it is, it's on the tongue. But humans don't. And but otherwise, balance is three-dimensional, and it's also extremely important, maybe even more so than any of the others. And the way I prove that is I say, all right, just imagine having only balance as a perception. That's it. You couldn't see, you couldn't hear, you couldn't feel nothing. Just balance. Get on a roller coaster and see how real it is, big time.
Look at ballerinas. I mean, in order for them to do all the spins, they turn their head, yeah. And they can sort of do with the flow, the liquid actually inside.
And, you know, balance is considered one of the finest things that a human can do as far as, like, talents like that. Everything. I mean, sports, anything you can imagine. If it wasn't for balance, it's definitely not hearing. That's a whole different ball game. It may come from the same organ, you know, the anvil and hammer and the there's other little parts there, but two things that are both three-dimensional and both extremely different. Hearing is nothing at all like balance, nothing even similar. You can separate the two very easily, and both are very strong. Matter of fact, did you know when it comes to three-dimension? Well, they're all extremely three-dimensional, but hearing is actually better than eyesight in that respect, because you can hear a completely 360 sphere around you. Anyway, the base concept here, all we have is our senses. That's the only way we experience life. And all of it is indication. None of it is actually doing the thing or seeing the thing or hearing the thing or anything. It's all indication. It's all effect. You know, the three-dimensional aspect of eyesight, for instance, is so extremely everything. I mean, what would you be without your three-dimensional eyesight? And yet three-dimensional eyesight doesn't, you know, the effect is an indication. It doesn't even work verbally or by definition. It's an effect. It's like time. Time is an effect of motion. Time is an effect of objects, matter, and motion. That's all time is. Very, very real. At least it seems that way. I mean, you better get to your honey's birthday on time. You're going to be wishing that you and time both didn't exist. Yeah. But, and I mean, where are you going to be without time? I mean, it's built into every language. Time truly, actually, and this is scientific. Einstein said this, time doesn't actually exist. It doesn't have any physical properties, you know. It doesn't take up any space, and it has no weight, not even molecular weight, none. It because it doesn't exist. It's an effect. It's an effect of objects in motion. Because that's all that actually exists, is objects and those objects in motion. Everything we are is that. But to get back to, you know, human perception and human senses, it's all indication. We don't have any other way. You know, for instance, eyesight. The light comes, say, from the sun, and it bounces off some rocks and the trees and whatever over in the distance. That reflects towards you. It scatters. I mean, the light goes everywhere. But the eyes have the ability to focus on that light coming directly towards the eye. That goes into your eyeball, back of your eyeball, and then it's transferred into electrical impulses, which are also something that only exist as electricity, and nobody even knows what that is. And it moves at the speed of light, except for through the human body. And through the human body, it moves about the speed of a horse-drawn cart. But that just has to do with the fact that there's a lot of friction involved, just like everything on Earth, lots of friction. But it's still just indication that electricity carrying that signal is just an indication of that light that came into the eye. And then it goes into the brain, and then the brain processes it, and that's all done with different electronics and different things, chemical and electrical. And, you know, the way to prove that what's in your head, your perception, is not real is because you can't think something and just make it happen. There's a lot of people in the paranormal that think it can, but they can't prove it. You can go to Las Vegas and find people who can really make it look like it's happening. It's all magic, you know, illusion. You know, the truth is, if we can't even prove we exist, because the closest stars to a very closest stars, which are 3.4 approximately light years from us, and light travels at 186,000 miles per second, they're almost 20 trillion miles away. And the biggest effect there is, the number one, other than matter, and that's what I started into, matter can't be proven to be, in fact, it's never been proven to exist. You can say it exists. You can work with it. You can detail it. I mean, there's jillions of details. But the fact is, you can't find anything but space. In fact, the distance between the here and the nearest star, like I say, almost 20 trillion miles. The distance between stars is the same thing. The distance between galaxies is many, many times that. The distance from here to the edge of the known universe is like, you couldn't even put it on paper. It has to be written as like a figure and then to the 25th or something, you know? It's a ridiculous figure. And of course, you can't possibly fathom it, but that's all there is out there. And then when you go down, you know, you come down from the planet size to human size, that's another huge gap. And then you look at matter, the ground, your hand, or whatever. It's made up of molecules, and then it's made up of atoms. And atoms actually are kind of a miniature solar system in a way, because the nucleus of an atom is made up of a lot of things, but it has more mass by far. I mean, it's like comparing the sun to a planet, any of them. In our solar system, the planets, all of them combined, only make up a fraction of the mass of the sun. And they are way out there. I mean, and this is the same thing with an atom. The electrons that orbit around an atom are so far away, it's the same ratio, basically. Basically. There's nothing there. And, of course, they found quarks and all kinds of little things. They call them subatomic particles. And they don't even really know how those things work. They're working on it. They're working on it. But it doesn't matter. What are those made of? What are subatomic particles actually made of? They can't be solid. And so far, they can. In fact, that's the deal. They discovered, you know, atoms. And at first, they thought the nucleus of an atom was like one solid thing. No. Turns out it's made out of a number of things. And they're all like spheres. Electrons are like spheres, or at least they seem to be. They're so small they can't really tell, but it's all space. So in that respect, no matter where you go, way down, way up, you can't find anything but space. And space is nothing. So where's the existence? Maybe we don't even exist. I mean, we can't prove it. Nobody can. So the only proof for time or matter or anything, okay, is to do it on the basis of a concept of that particular thing. You have to use a concept to have anything to go on. Maybe we should get back to what you really want to talk about, Nick. You know, the incident, you know, talked about the Phoenix Lights quite a bit. People don't want to hear about that, so we might as well get off it. But I know that people do like to hear about the Walton abduction.
But before we get to Travis, illusions, you know, they can lie to us. You know, it lies to our senses.
Yes.
You know, the information you're actually taking in and it's been absorbed by your brain. What actually got you interested in natural illusions, Mike?
The incident in 1975 with Travis Walton. Travis was never attacked by the skeptics, but I was big time because they insisted I was the ringleader, you know.
Let's begin there. Let's go back to November 5th, 1975, Mike.
Okay.
Would you like to begin there and just let the audience know what yourself and your other co-workers experienced, please, Mike?
Yeah, well, I was the crew boss, and so it was my truck and my equipment and everything, but I had six guys in the truck. It was a crew cab. It was four guys in the back and three in the front, two to my right. I was driving. And we were trying to catch up on this contract. It was already starting to get winter. Wasn't snowing or anything yet, but it was the sun would set fairly soon. So we worked up until dark, and we loaded up and everything. By the time we got all of that done and got in the truck and drove up a ways to the site, what we call a site now, it was dark enough we could see light coming through the trees. And everybody at first, you know, it was kind of like the movie. Movie isn't exactly accurate. In fact, some things aren't accurate about it at all, but some things are like the way they were acting. Everybody was acting, you know, not really paying attention at first, and then it becomes more and more interesting. And we're talking about a matter of a couple of minutes here, not hours or anything. But very quickly, everybody got very interested. And then we came around this thicket of trees, big trees, small trees. Travis yelled, "Stop the truck," you know. And so I did. But I couldn't see the object that they were seeing because it was kind of up a hill and it was in the air. Besides, I had to stop the truck just to see what it. Travis had already jumped out. He was walking up there, and nobody else did. Ken Peterson was sitting between me and Travis, and the other guys. Alan Dallas was in the back seat against the door, but nobody was clamoring to get out. Travis, the only one that did. But I understood that because him and I had chased bears before. People don't know that you can chase a bear and they'll run from you, but they sure as heck will. Now, if you act intimidated, they'll come after you. But if you run at them, they'll run away. Anyway, he always liked to grandstand for these guys because he liked to dazzle everybody with bravery, right? He's a young guy. He's 22. Anyway, you know, that's what you expect from somebody that age. I was 28, so I wasn't quite that, you know, boisterous, but he jumped out and I understood why, you know, and he walked up there, started walking up there. He was actually walking quite quickly at first, and then he slowed down. And he got up there pretty close, but by this time I had to actually turn the truck off and put the emergency brake on so that I could lean over and see what it was, because it was off to the right and up the hill, like I say, and I couldn't see it. It was, you know, above the top of the window there, looking out the right side. And when I did, I was shocked. I mean, it was incredible. I've expressed it. Some of the other guys, too, have like it was like a shiny new car. It didn't have the shape of a car, but it was like a shiny, like a really super shiny, super cool car. It had a kind of a glassy looking surface because it was reflecting. Because it was, first of all, it was giving off light, but at the same time, it was reflecting the light of the objects that it was lighting up. And of course, I painted all that photorealistically, but that's what it looked like. And it was just sitting there at first. When Travis got up there nearly underneath it, and the only reason he didn't is because there was a big slash pile there that the cats had pushed up, because it had been logged right in that area just not very long before that. And he couldn't get directly under it because that slash pile was in the way. So he just stood there. you know, had his hands in his pockets, you know, just his fingers looking up. And then the dadgum thing started to move. And at the same time, it started emitting some very strange sounds that were low at first. I mean, low sounds and high sounds, but they increased in volume from near zero at first. And they increased in volume. And pretty soon, the low sound was rumbling the truck. I mean, you could feel it. Wasn't quite as dramatic as they showed in the movie, but you know, they do that for effect. But yeah, you could feel it pretty good. And that was spooky. That scared everybody. But we were already scared because what Travis was doing just seemed to be crazy. And most of the guys in the truck realized that Travis was showing off. And they thought, well, he's bit off too much this time because now he's in trouble. And it turned out they were right because within a few seconds, I mean, he got scared enough that he turned to leave and bang. I mean, he actually had crouched down on the ground, down on his knees, you know, like behind this log that was sticking up there out of that slash pile, like to hide from it or something, because what else was he going to do? I mean, that was just a reaction. But he decided that wasn't going to work, so he stood up. As soon as he stood up, bang, something hit him. I mean, it's been described with all kinds of things, like a long blue flame or a beam. Travis personally now thinks it was static electricity. That's what he believes. This thing was winding up, and it was creating static electricity. I think he could feel it kind of. But when he stood up, it discharged into him and killed him, probably. He hit the ground, you know, 10 feet away. At least his feet did. His head went back like 15, 20 feet. But his feet went back about 10 feet because when he hit the ground, he's laying down flat. And that's one thing that the skeptics jump on. You said 10. Ken said 15. John said 20. Oh, gosh. Consider standing up and laying down flat. Now give me the dimensions. You know, but they use anything they can. So that's just one of the things I had to battle them over. But anyway, back to the story. Travis hit the ground for all intent and purpose, just totally limp. I mean, limp, like he just didn't have anything to him. It was just a sack of potatoes, as one of the guys said. And when he hit the ground, he kind of bounced. You know, bounced and then kind of bounced backwards a little bit more. But he didn't flinch. He didn't move. And what hit him was so powerful. I mean, it lit up the entire woods, even on the other side of the truck. I knew that because I had glanced over to start the truck back. Because even before Travis got hit, I was thinking caution. You know, I was thinking, whoa, we better not. You know, I didn't think this. I just did it. And the woods all lit up like this blue-green color. I mean, for way back and lighter, brighter than day. I mean, like two or three times the intensity of the sun. Anyway, I just as soon as I heard that pop, because it made a definite sort of a zapping sound. I don't know any other way to describe it. But when that happened, I just very quickly spun my head back over that way and saw him in midair. And anyway, I already had the truck started by this time. I stayed just a couple of seconds to see, you know, but Travis was thinking he might get up or something, but he didn't. And everybody was yelling at me to get the hell out of there. So since the truck was already going, I hit the gas. And it was panic. Yeah, it was panic. I was a pretty brave guy too, but the unknown will panic anybody. The real unknown. A situation like that. Anyway. Yeah, we went down the road. After we'd gone like maybe an eighth of a mile, which wasn't very far, just 200 or 300 yards, I was thinking, man, I can't drive off like this. But it took me like another eighth of a mile to actually slow down and stop, which I did. And I stopped, and everybody was saying, "What in the world are you doing this for?" I mean, all the guys. One of the guys, the only one there, Steve Pierce, who didn't say anything. He was just like catatonic. But I stopped, and then there was this turmoil, this argument. Everybody was saying, "Why in the world are you stopping?" Well, I can't leave him back there. We don't know what happened to him. We can't just drive off and leave him. Where are we going to go? Just get the hell out of here. That's all. So we sat there for several minutes. I don't know, 10 minutes or more, arguing about it. I kept saying, we got to go back. And then finally, Ken agreed with me. And then some of the other guys realized, yeah, we're going to, finally I said, and this is where it departs from the movie. I said, "I am going back. Anybody that doesn't want to go with me, they can stand here by the side of the road." Of course, he's only a quarter of a mile away from where it happened. But it was very dark by then. The woods were dark and, spooky woods, But everybody decided to get in the truck and go back with me. So we did. Now, in reality, I briefly, the movie doesn't show this, but I took their advice and there was a camper. We could tell it was a hunter. A pickup, came by, had a camper on the boat. And we were almost at the main road, okay? We were just 100 yards from it. So I couldn't turn around where I was anyway. It was too small of a space. The road was very narrow. And I would have had to gone out on the main road anyway to turn around, which I did. And very briefly, we took off after this truck, And I thought, no, that ain't going to work. These guys were going pretty fast and they'd already got way ahead. I thought, we got to go back. And so we did. And we were back there in like 15 minutes. No sign of Travis. But one thing I didn't mention was that when we first got out of the truck after it stopped it there, me and a couple of other guys getting out of the truck, our impulse was to look back that way. And we saw a light, which, of course, we're talking a quarter of a mile through the forest, which was fairly dense, great big trees. Saw a light raise up in the distance, a quarter of a mile away, right more than where it would have been. And then it just gained speed and streaked away towards the northeast. Kind of let me know that, hey, it's safe to go back. We need to go back. But, it was always on my own. Anyway, we did. Without too much more to do, we went back, and Travis wasn't there, and the object wasn't there, which I already pretty well figured it wasn't, but Travis wasn't there. I pulled my truck up in the clearing there, showing my headlights on that slash pile where Travis had been standing, and he wasn't there. So we got all the truck, and we started looking around. By this time, everybody's like shaking in their boots. So the search was like shoulder to shoulder, one arm in arm, shoulder to shoulder. Not continual, not like touching shoulders, but I mean pretty close, sometimes touching shoulders. And we took a circle up around through there and then we widened the search. We walked around two or three times and making the search wider and wider to where it got into the trees on the outside of the clearing. I couldn't find a footprint or anything. There was some footprints intermittently in the pine, between the pine needles from where Travis jumped out of the truck. That was pretty vivid where he jumped out of the truck. And then up through there, because the pine needles were intermittent because the dozer, which piled up the brush and stuff through this area, had done it not very long ago. And they had pretty much scoured the ground. A lot of pine needles were in that log pile. Some time had passed and pine trees lose needles constantly, but the dozer didn't push up all the pine needles either. So it was intermittent, and wherever those bare ground places were near bare ground, there were tracks leading up there. That's as far as they went. after we couldn't find him, and it became, I became quite emotional after that. I kind of broke down. Anyway, we went back to town, and unlike the movie, the sheriff and a couple of deputies who had a four-wheel drive and a car that was like four-wheel drive took three of us, me and two other guys, back up the hill and searched for Travis for another hour and a half after we had reported it. By this time, it was like 8:30, 9 in the evening. And no trace. This one guy who was driving this four-wheel drive said that he was an excellent tracker. He couldn't find a track on the roads anywhere, any road. There were several different roads. There weren't any tracks anywhere. It fell to me to go with one of those deputies, back to the skeptical deputy. The sheriff was skeptical, but this guy was like ridiculously skeptical. He was like a Maine skeptic, you know? People know what that is. Michael Shermer, Philip Klass, he was that type of skeptic. They took me over to inform Travis's mother. She lived 6-7 miles away in a different part. She lived in the woods too, but it was quite a ways away. And she was asleep when I got there. Knocked on the door. She came to the door after a while. She's in her robe. And, you know, I won't go into that because it gets pretty emotional, but it goes from there. And then we had this four-day search after that, which didn't include any helicopters, somewhere between 50, depending on the day and what time of day. There was anywhere from 50 to 100 men searching, made up of search and rescue and Forest Service and private individuals. Two helicopters eventually. They didn't show up until the second day. But there was two of them, and they 4 days of searching, and there was nothing. And some of the deputies on the ground and vehicles went and searched all the buildings, I mean, everything, within all the way from there to Heber, which was like 12 miles away. There were a few ranch houses and stuff. They turned them inside out. Some of these deputies were so thorough that they made people mad. They insisted that Travis had to be here somewhere, and they couldn't find him, even though they dug as deep as they could. And so finally, on a Sunday, because this original incident was on a Wednesday evening, so 4 days of searching took us up until the evening of a Sunday, and the sheriff says, we got into town and everything, he says, I want you guys to take a lie detector test. I didn't even know what one was. Alan Dallas did. I guess he had taken one before. He said, no way in hell. Well, how else are we going to prove that we're telling the truth? Alan and I did have a skirmish. In fact, it was a little bit worse than they showed in the movie. In the movie, it was just a little pushing each other stuff. I actually kind of beat him up. Alan and I had some harsh words. Anyway, and it wasn't just about that. It involved other things as well, but I won't get into that. But anyway, we went ahead and took the lie detector test, all of us, including Alan. He was still feisty as he was in the movie. Some of the things in the movie were quite accurate. Some things were very different. Such as I said, you know, we went back, all of us, and the movie, they decided that was too definite or so. I don't know why they did it, but they had the guys standing on the side of the road. That was absurd. But anyway, had the lie detector tests, and that was pretty much almost exactly the way it showed in the movie. I mean, I was adamant, and Alan was an ass, you know, and the guy who played the part, you know, James Garner, he played actually in the movie, he played a state investigator, which didn't exist. It was actually a national investigator named Philip Klass. But Philip Klass never came there. So James Garner's part was just kind of a make-believe part, but it worked pretty good for the movie. That's another departure of the movie. But, you know, it all worked because Philip Klass came down on us virtually, you know, on the phone or whatever, in mail. And the internet was just basically getting started back then. But yeah, any way he could. He wrote all kinds of white papers and stuff. And I had to battle all that stuff. And I proved, you know, that every single thing. And this is not just wanting it to be true. I'm a realist. I've always been a realist. So when I tore into Philip Klass, I did on the basis of facts. For instance, he was so adamant about destroying this case that he would make up stuff. And the night that the movie premiered, Travis and I were in Washington, D.C., and we were already said it. We went on Larry King Live, and we were facing Phil Klass. And even there, he was spouting this made-up stuff, and I caught him at every single thing. Now, we didn't have a whole lot of time to go into detail on Larry King, but it worked because most people were familiar with everything anyway. A lot of people did. And so just mentioning a particular thing, you know, pretty good. We shut him down. We did, and that's pretty much a fact. But he would make up these things. He would make up misquotes. You know, one time he misquoted me from a book, which was stupid because the book is something in existence. And it was a book called Ultimate Encounter by Bill Berry. And that actually came out before our book. And there was a conversation there that happened between me and Steve Pierce. And Steve wasn't really with us at this time. This was a couple of months later, you know, maybe 4 or 5 months later. And Steve was he was the youngest guy there, and he was very emotional, at least at the time. And so Philip Klass pretty much made it a point to take advantage of Steve's age, which he was 17. He lied to me about his age. He wasn't 18, 17. And so Philip Klass made the most of it. And there was a conversation where Steve had called me. And I know the wording of it because I recorded the call, because I was in the business of recording everything, because Philip Klass was constantly calling me, bugging me always. And he would record it. I thought, well, I'm not going to allow this, because he would immediately write a paper about it and he would lie about it. He'd make up stuff I said. So I started recording my conversations, all of them. And I had to be on the ready because he would always call me at, there was no announcement for the moment. And so that's why I was doing it. So I caught this call with Steve Pierce. And Steve said, and I don't have the words right in front of me, but it went like, Philip Klass had offered him $10,000 to say that it was a hoax. And Steve had a little trouble with that because it really happened. But he was also very broke. Because we lost our job, for one thing, he was broke anyway. So he was very enticed by that. So he gives me this call, and he says a lot of the other normal stuff first. Finally, he gets into it. And this part was quoted in this book by Bill Berry, where I says, would you really take that money, even though it really happened? And he said, well, I was thinking about it. I says, well, if you do, you'll be bruised, you know, which was, of course, a threat. I wouldn't have done it, but you'll be bruised and you'll spend the money alone because it really happened. You know that. Bill Berry put all that in a book. And on Larry King Live, Philip Klass brought that out again, you know. And the thing of it is, what he cut out, both in the white papers and then in one of his books, the very first book he wrote after this, which was like 2 years later, there it was right there. He wouldn't leave it alone. He misquoted. He left out some very important lines, like, even though you know it really happened, he left that line out, which made it look like I was saying, you would take the money? And And then he leaves that line out. And then Steve says, yeah, I was thinking about it. And then I say, well, then you'll be bruised. See, so the way Philip Klaus made it look like I was just threatening because it didn't really happen. But he had to leave that line out. He had to leave several lines out. That's the kind of thing Phil Klaus would do. And that was just the beginning of that stuff. The reason I got into Natural Illusions was because of not just Klaus, but like Oberg and Robert Schaefer, a couple of others, you know, main outspoken skeptics. They kept hitting me, not Travis, but they kept hitting me with the, it was an illusion. It was an illusion. You guys saw Venus, or you guys saw ball lightning. You guys saw this, you saw that. They would just throw everything. And so I started getting into the study of illusions. And at first I couldn't find anything. Nobody lists these things down. Nobody categorizes them like I have. And nobody actually explains them. Nobody even names them. In fact, the name natural illusion is something I came up with. You won't find that in any dictionary or anything. Natural illusion. And the reason it's a separate category altogether is because it's things that you cannot ignore. There are things that are there. Just like the stars. The stars are actually appear over 3,000 times larger and closer than they really are. If it wasn't for that, now you talk about an illusion. If it wasn't for that, we wouldn't see a single star. The skies would be jet black. There wouldn't be anything except a pale, pitiful moon. That's it. The sun. You wouldn't even be able to see the planets because even the planets shine. Even though they're indirect light, the reflected light, they have this thing called light flare. And that's why we can see them. We see stars because of a light flare. And that light flare is actually over 3,000 times brighter than the star, the size of the star. If you could make a star, just hypothetically, shiny, but no bigger, no appear no larger than it actually is, they are so far away that we wouldn't be able to see a thing. And the stars are like a million miles in diameter. The sun is close to that. It's like 870,000 miles, and it's like 93 million miles from us. By the way, even the sun and the moon produce an illusion. If you imagine the moon coming up front, you can't do this so much with the sun, but even though apparently they have the apparent same size, that's why you have an eclipse where the moon can cover the sun almost perfectly, almost exactly, or not quite exactly the same, but apparently, you know, in our eyes, they are of the apparent same size. You know, the moon is, well, 230 some thousand miles. That's what it is. The sun is 93 million miles. If you wait for a full moon to come over the horizon, even a supermoon, any moon, supermoon, they're really not really any different size. They just appear that way. But try to imagine before that moon comes looming over the rise, how much of a moon you could cover, or how many you could cover, or what part of a moon you could cover with your outstretched thumb. And everybody misses that. They think, oh, I've had people say, well, the moon is like three times wider than my thumb, okay? And I've had people say, well, I could pretty well cover it. Nobody understands until they do it. You could put as many as 30 moons, cover that many. And we're talking about your thumb is like, say three wide and 12 long. And that's actually what you could do. That's, you know, the moon will appear like about one third the width of your thumb. And if you say, how many can cover with your thumb? Three widths, okay? And however long it is. And that's my thumb. Now, a woman's thumb, they're going to only see, I won't cover like my last girlfriend could only cover 10, but my gosh. In the movies, the special effects in the movies. They always make the moon extremely huge, and they have to do that because if everybody in cinematography knows that if you film the moon, you can't even see it. It's so dinky, you can barely see it. You certainly can't use it in a movie for anything that involves the moon because it won't work. So they have to actually manufacture a moon and make it appear, oh, like 50 times bigger than the moon really is. Anyway, that's just one illusion. I have found so many, you wouldn't believe, so many, many illusions. A lot of them have to do with stars, but a lot of them I have that are just to do with ordinary things. I've already talked about matter, you know, how it is all space and everything. I've already talked about the effect thing, which is comprises because of effect, indication. It makes up everything that we experience in terms of perception, everything, which all indication doesn't really exist. So that, of course, is one of the illusions. But, you know, give you a little one for instance, just a little one. Have you ever gone back to a, say, your school where you went to school as a kid? And to say it's been 5, 10, 20 years since then. But when you were there, the inside of this library looked, to you, it looked ordinary. But when you go back again after, like, say, a 10-year break, interim, the inside of that library will have just shrunk by half. And that happens every time because it's a natural illusion. There isn't any way you can get around it. And if you keep, I mean, you might be able to get used to it, but that's the only way you'll know. And if you leave for another so many years, come back, it'll have shrunk again. Of course, the building didn't shrink. It's just in your mind. So they're all mental illusions. They're all mental because they're all perception. But the natural illusions are things you can't avoid. Let me bring up another one here. Okay, distance. This one I just recently illustrated, and it goes like this. A faraway natural illusion on the human scale is definitely distance and always way over there. That's right. Play words here too. The distant hills will always look closer than they actually are. To know how close the hills really are, you must go the distance. If walking the distance, it will seem extremely farther away than the distant hills really are. Only if you've gone the distance more than once will you begin to know, but only for a time, as natural illusions of distance changes after a reasonable elapsed period of time. And I have lots of examples of that. For instance, when I was a kid, not a little kid, like 12 years old, I would stay at my aunt's house, and she had several kids. One of them was my age, but she had three boys that were pretty close to my age. And they lived in Lakeside, Arizona, which is up in the mountains, real close to where I live now. But at the time, back then, which was like, I don't know, 200 or 300 years ago, seems that way. Anyway, in the hot summer, I would only be there in the summertime. It would be hot, even though it's the mountains, it might be 80 degrees. We thought it was really warm. So we would go down, walk down to this place called Billy Creek, and there was a swimming hole there. It was just a natural thing. It wasn't dug out or anything, but you know, we could swim there. Anyway, when I was a kid, I kind of dreaded that because, in fact, I remember having conversations where I'd say, come on, guys, I don't want to go down there. I want to go down there to swim. We're going to get so overheated just going down there because it's so far away. And sometimes we didn't go because it did seem very far away. And I was like the oldest, you know, I was like 12. My cousin Doc was like 11. Bobby was like 9, like that. Sometimes we would go, but man, it sure seemed like a long ways away. Last summer, I went back to that very spot, even though my uncle sold all that property and now there's housing developed. You know, the creek is still there. And my aunt's house is still there. And I checked it out, only a quarter of a mile away. And I thought it was miles. I mean, it seemed like 3 miles, like maybe 3 miles, actually only a quarter of a mile. So I run into these illusions. I mean, here's an easy one. If you're going down the highway at highway speed, any, you know, freeway, any highway, as long as it's like open enough that you can do this. Look at the dashed line in front of you, whether it's a lane divider or a highway where it's the center line. look at that line. And you, when you look at it, and if you, that's the only thing you know about it, which most people don't even think about this until then. And the, I've done this many times with several groups of people over the years. And you will, you would swear that those lines are like three, somewhere between 3 and 6 feet long. Swear. And so I'll tell them, you know, well, estimate what they are, and then we'll pull over and check it out. A lot of people go, oh, well, what, like four and a half? I say, well, let's find out. Pull over the side of the road, and safely, of course, go to the side of the road, not in the road, just to look at it, and you'll find out that those lines are actually somewhere between 18 and 24 feet long, depending on whether it's a highway or a freeway. On the freeways, they get up to like 25 feet long, sometimes 30. And they all look like 3 to 6 feet long when you're in your vehicle moving. And of course, there's reasons for that, which I won't go into because it gets kind of involved. But all that is going to be in my book. Already is in my book, actually. There are so many illusions. And it all started because of Travis Walton's incident.
Your book, Mike, is it ready? Is it up for release yet?
Oh, no, no. I haven't released it yet because I keep coming up with sample of illusions. I put one on there like every day, every couple of days at the minimum.
Okay, what we'll do is then, we're in the show notes below this episode, we put all links to Mike, and we're talking about to the Realist, his radio show, which I suggest people go listen to because it's absolutely, I love it at the minute. That's one of my favorite shows. To Mike's Facebook. And so, yeah, so when your book comes out, people will be able to grab a copy.
You bet, yeah. When it comes out, yeah. Philip Mantle has already offered to publish it, but I don't know. I've got a couple of feelers out. I've got some good hits already, but we'll see what happens. It'll be published, you definitely.
You know, a lot of my listeners, they are scientifically minded, and some of them actually do have, you know, are very scientific but based, you know, job wise and also a lot of realists, so I think a lot of people will connect with you, Mike, and a lot exactly what you're saying. And you know, you've bear witness to some interesting things. But going back to Philip Klass, now anyone that knows anything about ufology knows the name Philip Klass.
Oh, and yeah.
All you can say about him is the guy is a class act, or was a class act, because he's been passed quite
yeah.
a few years now.
Yeah.
A class act, you know.
Yep.
And I think Stanton Friedman, you know, the great Stanton Friedman, would also agree, you know, because they crossed paths many
Stanton
occasions.
Stanton was a realist. He certainly was.
He was. He was.
Yeah, well, it was like me, you know. Of course, I believe in a certain amount of the paranormal. And I believe anything can happen because as a realist, I'm unbiased. If you're unbiased, you don't just say definitely this or definitely that, one way or the other. It's like I'm an agnostic. Not because I don't disbelieve in God, it's because I just don't know. And as a realist, what else could I say? Because I'm not going to be biased and say, you know, because I was raised a Mormon, okay? Snowflake, Arizona. Almost everybody in the town, my family, everybody, they were Mormon. Well, when I was reached the age of reason, like two and a half, something like that. No, I'm just kidding about that. Actually, I became a priest when I was in my 20s. I taught Sunday schools. I was pretty much into it, but I always had in the back of my mind that something not quite right here. How can anybody, because I kept noticing that people were unrealistic about it. And, you know, when you're a logger in the woods, you've got to be a realist or you'll die. And I've had a lot of several friends who have actually died logging. It happens to be the number two most dangerous profession in America or in the world for all. There's only one profession, and that's that fishing, like lobster fishing and other kind of fishing they do up in the North Sea. That's number one, but logging is number two. And later on in life, I got into tree service because I quit logging because I didn't like cutting those big trees anymore. I mean, I liked it. Yeah, I made quite a bit of money, but I just couldn't do it. You know, I just couldn't do it. You know, I won't go into all that, but I grew a conscience about it. I became realistic about it. And so I went into the tree service business. I became a tree specialist and a tree surgeon.
While I have you on trees, now, the actual location in the Apache Sitgreaves National Park where the incident happened, am I right in thinking that there was growth defects with the trees in the surrounding area?
Oh, yeah. After the incident, yes. We didn't notice that for a few years. In fact, it wasn't noticed actually until a winter when there was like 4 feet of snow on the ground up there. And Paramount wanted to get in there because they were pushing for certain programs. Can't remember which one. We did several, dozens actually. But one of them wanted to get in there to the actual site. I couldn't find the site. I couldn't find it. I knew the road. I knew the lay of the land. You know, there back then. And the reason I couldn't find it was because there was no longer a clearing. In fact, the trees there were way, way bigger than they should have been. And so during the summer, the very next summer, I went in there and, you know, when the snow was cleared enough away to get in there. And I did some surveying. The first thing I did was just investigate. And then I spent like a week there, laying it all out. And definitely, without going through all the details of that, those trees had grown phenomenally fast. And not just like earthworms or things over in Chernobyl, which is something that, because of, you know, radiation, grew much faster. These trees, which were facing that UFO, and I don't know if it was radiation or what it was, they grew lopsided as well. They grew faster altogether, all around. And matter of fact, they were adding wood at the rate of 32 times normal. And that was all done statistically by calculations and verified. And but a fire went through the area back in 2002 and pretty much cleaned all that out. But the big trees that were left, or some of them were left, but those that weren't were cut down. And now if you look at those rings, that wood that grew after the incident, because you can count the rings in a tree. You know, you can count, you can find out exactly what year you're talking about. And from 1975 on, all that wood, which a humongous amount of wood, had rotted away. I mean, not completely, not to dust, but it was rotted. And the tree that was existed prior to that was solid, even though they're dead trees. But we'd documented all that way back then. And people wanted to come out and investigate and stuff, depending on whether they were believers or skeptics. The skeptics I knew only had one thing in mind, so we wouldn't even bother to take them out there. A couple of guys who were truly scientific, I went in there with them and they agreed with it all. And then there was a lady who basically investigated crop circles, and she was very, very biased in that respect. And even though I agreed to it at first, she kind of got on the bandwagon, decided that she wanted to film it and make some money off of it stuff. I said, no, we're not going to do that. So she just gave up and got mad at me, and now she's hated me ever since. Anyway, it's still documented. And it's been on some programs, you know, TV. I can't remember exactly which ones, but you know, the ones you'd expect.
Because there is a very good documentary, which I believe you're in as well, called The True Story of Travis Walton on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, that's a documentary done by Jennifer Stein. And it's very, very accurate. There is another film, which, in my opinion, outdid the movie. You know, it was full of actors. It had all of us guys that were left anyway. There was only two of us have actually died. And one we don't know about. Ken Peterson, I've been trying to find him, but I can't. In fact, nobody has yet. He's been gone for like 4 years, so we don't know what happened to him. So really, there's only three of us left out of seven.
Because for our younger listeners, for those not familiar with this story, because it does happen. Now, the 1993 movie Fire in the Sky, even though it's a good film, it's not really that accurate. Of course, because Robert Patrick played you, Mike, didn't he?
You bet, yeah.
Yeah.
And Robert Patrick and I became friends even before the movie was filmed, right when they were starting. He came to Snowflake. He didn't find us, but he did after that. He found me, and he found Travis too, but he wanted to do a character sketch of me. So I was very proud of what he did in the movie because that was very, very good. And my gosh. Yeah.
I mean, his character really stands out, Mike.
Oh, yeah. D.B. Sweeney played Travis Walton. And he did a pretty good job, but Robert Patrick did a dynamite job of me. That was real true. He did a very good job, a character sketch, because he spent a lot of time with me, and he was serious about it. He's a very serious actor. He'd done a lot of movies, so he's a good guy, and I've been friends with him ever since. We did a lot of shows together. After the movie came out, Good Morning America, Geraldo, two or three others. He didn't go with us and Travis when we went on the world tour to promote Fire in the Sky, but he did on all these stateside things. So Robert Patrick's still my friend. We've exchanged Christmas cards and everything else, you know. He even likes to make an issue of how his wife is related to me, which she is. That's just coincidental, though. Just, you know, her family lived in Snowflake for a while, and you know, so it's just coincidental. Those things happen. It's not anything special. Robert tries to make it special, you know, you expect that, but
that's excellent.
Yeah, James Garner played an interesting character. He played a character named Blake Davis, but he was a state investigator, which didn't exist. The skeptic was Phil Klass and James Oberg and a few others, you know, mainly Phil Klass. And so they were kind of like taken after that, but at the same time, making him into a cowboy character because the whole thing is supposed to be cowboy. It was kind of that way back then. I used to wear a cowboy hat, but I never rode a bull. I never rode a bucking horse, you know. I did other dangerous things, very dangerous, but I didn't ever do that.
Well, you worked chainsaws. I mean, that's dangerous enough.
Oh, chainsaws. Oh, man. You know, over the years when I was in the woods, I almost always ran a crew, okay? Anywhere from five men up to as many as 20 at times. I have seen some horrendous things with chainsaws. I've had people cut their throat with a chainsaw. In fact, my brother was one of those, and he did it twice at the same time. He's got two great big scars across his neck. He nearly bled to death because always very far away from the nearest doctor. He almost did bleed to death. But there's been several others that came very close to dying because that is so dangerous. And that's not even getting hit with a tree. That's just with a chainsaw.
I was going to say, the chainsaw is enough, but getting hit by a big old heavy tree, you know?
Yeah. Do you know, we've done thinning with what we call thinning, where we cut up to like 9-inch in diameter pines. They're usually dead or deformed or just growing too thick. And I've done quite a bit of that too. But you know, I found out that even a pine tree, say 20 feet tall and 6 inches in diameter, this has happened several times, because when it gets to these smaller trees, that's where guys they're not careful. And they'll hit somebody else with a tree that's small of a tree, which it'll knock them flat. I had one guy get hit that way by a six inch diameter tree, 20 feet tall, maybe 22. He was out for an hour. We thought he was going to die. We thought he'd broken his neck or something. Rushed him to town, all that stuff. So, yeah, even though little trees can hurt you very badly, but a 9-inch diameter tree will kill you. And from there up, when I was on the north rim of the Grand Canyon logging, I got into a special team up there that only cut really big trees. And we had to be really good because we got paid on the basis of what we did. And I was number one out of a 35-man crew, of course, and bragging, but it's a fact. I used to make $300 to $500 a day because we were paid, like I say, by what we do. In other words, the number of trees we get down, how well we do it, there's lots that goes into it, but that's what we did. Very dangerous, and I've had lots of friends die, lots of them.
As to be expected. I mean, that was very good money, and that's good money now, let alone in those days.
Oh, yeah. Well, for a commoner, like somebody from northern Arizona, to make even $200 a day is like twice normal. Of course, this only lasted for 3-4 months, but that's what I got into finally. And I did that for like 3 years. And I had an incident up there, by the way, but I don't want to get it. Actually, the best way to find out about that incident, which is like my third, actually fourth, because Travis and I and a group and a car full of people going down to Phoenix saw a sphere fairly close that did some very, very novel things. That was 5 years before, okay? Then the Travis thing happened. And then, of course, the Phoenix Lights happened in 1997. But in 1990, I had an experience that probably tops them all when I was alone camping on a place called Fire Point on the north rim of the Grand Canyon in the park. We were logging, not in the park, but away from there. But that's a whole different story. And the best way to hear about that is my show. Let's see, when was that? Let me look at my calendar here. On August 1st, okay. I don't know what the date is on my archives, probably the 2nd or 3rd of August, but it was aired on the 1st. That is where I finally, for the first time, even though I usually don't talk about myself, I had a guest. Her name was Nancy Tremaine.
Mm-hmm, I know Nancy,
a very emotional person. Her experience really affected her. And that's one of the things that I lean very strongly in favor of, the things I don't. But anyway, she only wanted to be on for an hour, my ABBA two-hour show. So after the first hour with her, I would said goodbye. My producer, Bill Forte, because I'd ask him this, ahead of time, at least before the show, a few minutes before, we got to do something for the second hour. So I'm going to tell this story that the first time, but I don't want to just tell it, So I told that story that happened on North Rim of the Grand Canyon for the very first time on that show. And then we followed it up the next week, or at least a couple of weeks later. Anyway, that's where you can hear it. It's in my archives. Now, my archives are on the Mike Heston Rogers Facebook page. It's also on the KGRA page, which is, for me, is The Realist is Mike Heston Rogers Facebook. And either place, you can scroll down. Now, on The Realist is Mike Heston Rogers page, you don't have to go scroll that far down to find it, but it's a place that talks about archives. And there's a yellow star there, and you click on the star, and it brings up all my archives. On my page, however, it's kind of buried because I put an awful lot on there. So you have to scroll down a ways, but it's there. Click on the yellow star, and all my archives are there. So you can hear that stuff. And, of course, there's all kinds of stuff on my page. Pretty much tells about me and my life and just about everything. Mostly about natural illusions and mental illusions and man-made illusions.
I know people are going to want to hear about this. So all the links to Mike in the show notes below and also on the UFO Chronicles website from the episode page. You can also catch The Rear List with Mike Heston Rogers on KGRA.
Saturday night at 10 p.m. Pacific. That's actually, if you're going by Eastern time, it's actually 1 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. Because there's like, this time of year, there's a 3-hour difference. I'm in northern Arizona, but Arizona time doesn't ever change. So at this time of year, we're the same as Pacific time. Even though the states above us are on Mountain Standard Time, Arizona is the only logical state in the union for several reasons. But one of them is we don't ever change the time. So I call that AZ time, Arizona time. But it's 3 hours ahead or behind, whichever way you look at it. And so the show actually airs at 1 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning, Eastern time. I don't know how that equates or to where you are, but that's what it is here.
10 p.m. Pacific is 6 a.m. GMT.
Well, that's pretty. Everybody's asleep at that time.
I know, right?
So you know, you gotta go into my archives if you really want to hear it. And of course, my show will show up within a day. Normal, sometimes within hours after it's actually aired, they're all there. Once in a while, Bill Forte gets so busy that he takes him a day or two, even a day, a couple of days sometimes to actually put, you know, a past show in my archives. They'll get there, as you can tell.
That's great, Mike. I really appreciate you coming on today. I'm very, very happy that you decided to come and share for our listeners today.
You bet.
Sure.
I have a joke. It's another illusion, okay? It goes like this. I've done a lot of walking in the deep, scary woods, which of course I have, and I won't say I've never seen an illusion out there, but quit throwing rocks at that big, dark-looking thing up the hill. The only way to make sure it isn't a bear is to walk up closer. You know, stoking the fire and wetting your pants won't help. Neither will jumping in your sleeping bag in the tent, covering your head. What if it's just waiting? Because the incredible patience of big burly stumps is well known.
That's excellent, Mike.
Those illusions happen all the time in the woods, you know. Oh man, I'm really into illusions, you know. And you know, those things prove to me that the Phoenix Lights was man-made. Don't know what it was, don't know who did it. It could have been the government, could have been a private individual, although it would have cost a lot of money, but it was definitely carried on the wind, both the elevation, the speed, and the change in direction. And my study of illusions showed me that the thing that happened to us with Travis Walton was very, very, very real. And there's several things other than that have happened. I haven't had a lot of experiences, but the ones I've had have all been looked at through unbiased eyes. And I have another little saying, you know, bias is so bad. Bias is wishful thinking. People get so glazed over with bias that they can't see the magical forest for the wishful trees. And that's a fact.
I like that.
People can't see what's really there. They get so biased, they get so much preconception, they decide what's going to be, and they miss what's really there. Happens all the time because of bias. You know, nobody should be like that because, you know, believing the wrong thing can kill you. It won't just mess up your life. It'll kill you. And I have lots of examples of that. Yeah, take the Salem witch hunt. That's just one. What about Applewhite and his cult that died the same year as the Phoenix Lights? The same time as the Phoenix Lights, really. Not very long apart. 40 people believed so much in what that guy was saying that they were going to go, if they would just drop their bodies, as he put it, they were going to go for a ride, a big UFO, in the tail of Hale-Bopp Comet.
That's right. Dangerous minds. And I couldn't be more than happy and thank you enough for coming on today, Mike. It's been absolutely fantastic hearing from you.
Well, I want to thank you. I really do. And I like the fact that people like you will take me serious enough to have me on your show because I don't consider myself famous. I suppose I am, but I don't feel that way. I don't act that way. I try not to, but I do like being heard. especially about the things that are real. And that's what I'm all about. So,
and I think that's important. I think that's what, you know, helps you come across with, you know, what you experience. And, you know, I appreciate it. And I know my listeners do as well.
Well, thank you, Nick. I appreciate this show. I appreciate you.
That is all for today. Thank you to Mike for coming on, and thank you for listening. I will be back next week with another witness encounter. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.